Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 84. Bringing you authors of science fiction and fantasy, publishing industry analysis, writing tips, book reviews, and the occasional belly laugh.
World while you were gone.
Nice segue there, Sean.
It's Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Oh yeah, we're brilliant.
Yeah, if you need a really, really tall blonde person, I'm your woman.
This is Lou Anders, editorial director of Pirate Book.
This is Tracy Hickman.
This is Sean Williams.
And now, your host. And welcome to another episode of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. I apologize for the delay between shows, but there are houses to sell, so Sam's going to join me later for an overdue feedback segment. But right now I am joined by Mark Chadbourne, author of The Silver Skull, Sword of Albion Book 1, and author of the Age of Misrule trilogy, all of which are published by our good friends at Pyre Books. Welcome to America, Mark.
Hello, Sean. Thank you very much.
See, you're in America today. I don't know if you knew that or not.
No, I travel around the world at the speed of light.
the speed of sound, anyway. I'm not... Yeah, whatever. Well, it's good to have you on the show, and thanks for making the time in your later evening, if not super late yet. But I do want to talk to you about The Silver Skull, the new book that's coming out here in the States in November. And can you start us off by telling us a little bit about the story?
Okay. In a line, it's Elizabethan spies versus fairy. The Elizabethan times saw the establishment of the Secret Service that we see today as MI5, MI6, which people will probably be aware of through the James Bond movies. I've always been fascinated by history, and I was fascinated by that particular time because it was as turbulent internationally as the world is today, and the politics within England, as it was at the time, are just as convoluted as they are in modern times. So the idea I came up with was, what was the real reason why this spy network was established? And it was to protect England from the powers that have preyed on the country and the people there for millennia. Finally, England is fighting back. It's established this spy network, and they're going to keep fairy at bay because they've been picking on the English people, taking them under their hills, leaving straw dolls in cots and getting the cows to give blood for generations. In a nutshell.
You know, the only way James Bond movies could be better is if you had to deal with that.
Exactly. I mean, the first one is set around the Armada, which I think a lot of people will be aware of from Elizabeth the Golden Age movie. It was the Spanish fleet that invaded Britain, invaded England. So it's the Silver Skull is based around the build-up to that invasion, and Will Swift is the hero. He's the spy, and he goes into Spain trying to stop the Armada and finds out that that they have are playing some role, let's say, in advising the Spanish.
Very cool. Pyre's publicist did send me a copy of the book. I haven't, unfortunately, had a chance to read it yet, but can you tell us what is the significance of the Silver Skull that the book is named after?
The Silver Skull is a doomsday weapon. It's a man, and he's got his head is encased in a magical skull that the Spanish want to use, fairy wants to use, and the English spies want to stop them using. And they're both sides are hunting this man down to stop him being used by one side or the other.
And is any part of the story told from his perspective?
Yes. Can't give too much away, but the identity of the person inside the skull is an important part of the story.
You know, you said earlier that you've been fascinated by history, and, you know, this is set in Elizabethan England. You have Age of Misrule. It's grounded in Celtic mythology. So you're obviously a history buff. Have you always been so?
I was always interested in history and folklore mythology, which, you know, cross over with history on several points. Ever since I was a kid, really. I mean, I just used to read books constantly about all aspects of world history, not just British history. And I did a history degree at university. It was a combination of history and economics. And it's been an interest ever since, really. I mean, it's great being in England because the history is everywhere you look. Yeah. Ancient history, modern history. You know, you can't go 5 miles without bumping into a castle or stone circles. So, you know, it's very much a part of life, and it's something that, you know, that always drew me in.
Well, you know, here you can't go 5 miles without hitting the shopping mall. I don't know if that's as inspiring, but you got to have something, right?
Absolutely. You've got a lot of great history there. I mean, in the times I've been to America, I've always probed around the different areas. You know, there's a lot going on there historically.
And you never know. Maybe 1,000 years from now, the shopping malls, people will think those were castles. And,
that's,
you know,
right. Great shrines to money.
There you go. You also mentioned this genre blending, this James Bond meets, you know, fairy. So the Silver Skull has a spy element to it. And Misrule, on the back of book one, is described as a high-octane fantasy thriller. So how do you approach these blending of genres that you seem to enjoy doing? If you even think about it at all, that is.
I don't think about it, really. I mean, I write the kind of books that I want to read. I write about what I'm interested in, and I just happen to be interested in things that move across several genres. You know, I'm interested in crime and psychology. I'm interested in science and mythology. And when I'm writing a book, I just want to throw all the things in there that I'm passionate about and build the stories around them. And it just so happens that, you know, the stories tend to come out all over the place. It must be a nightmare for the marketing people because they never know which shelf to stock them on. But, you know, it keeps me interested, and that's the main thing when you're writing, I think.
Well, it seems to me, just as a reader and a fan, that more and more books are blending several genres together. It doesn't seem like anything really fits into the pigeonholes anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing, though. I mean, it's very easy to get tired when you get the tropes of genres just repeating constantly. Yeah. And it freshens up storytelling. If you're bringing in things from other areas, add something new, it gives a completely different take on what was familiar, I think. And again, you know, the genre tropes were often very much marketing-driven. You know, the publishers will tell writers, look, this is science fiction or this is fantasy or whatever. But I think from a writer's point of view, you don't think like that. You just think of a story, you think of characters and a setting, and it could go in several different directions.
Yeah, I agree with you. I like it quite a bit. It makes it more interesting for me as a reader. When you're putting a book together and you're thinking about your characters and your story, are you the type of writer who says, okay, this is what the characters are going to do, or do they, you know, speak to you a little bit more and tell you what they're going to do?
When I plot a book or a sequence of books, I tend to have what I call tent poles. I've got points in the story that I know the characters need to reach to move the plot along. But around that, I leave it completely open. And I'll let the characters basically tell me where they're going to go. I think, you know, you're drawing on your unconscious when you're doing that. And that's where the really exciting, interesting things come from. When you just start writing and let, you know, your deep-seated thoughts just surface straight onto the page or onto the screen as you're typing it. Sometimes if you try and constrict it too much, it just sucks the life out of it, I think. And some of the most interesting things to me that I've written have come completely out of left field. I'm thinking, well, where did that come from? You know, and you just run with it then.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear different authors talk about this because some, you know, they're very strict. You know, you're in control. You tell the characters what to do. And when I'm right, I write a little bit, and I tend to be more of your way of thinking, that I have an idea of where I want the story to go, but you have to be honest about who the characters are and what they're going to do, you know?
I think so, yeah. I mean, to me, storytelling is really about the unconscious telling stories to your conscious mind. So, and the characters are often different aspects of your unconscious speaking, and you've got to give them that voice. If you try to control them too much, you're mediating, and I think, in a way, you can stop the really lively, interesting, deep stuff coming out by doing that. But that's just me, just the way I work, yeah.
Well, when are books 2 and 3 of The Swords of Albion coming out?
They're coming out annually, so book two will be out, I presume, next November. I have to talk to Lou about that. And book three, the year after that. I'm about halfway through the writing of book two now, so I hope to finish that by Christmas.
Are these coming out in the UK as well, or just here?
They're coming out from Random House in the UK. For once, they'll be up in America first, and the first Swords of Albion book will be out in the UK in April next year.
Yeah, it probably normally works the other way around, right?
It does, yes. Yeah, I think there was a slight screw-up on the scheduling front somewhere down the line, but it benefited Lou at Pyre, so he's very happy about that.
Cool. Do you think it will make any difference for you as far as your sales numbers go?
It's a bit of an issue at the moment. Obviously, we're in a global market. Publishers still try to pretend it's the last century where, you know, people only get local books. I mean, especially genre fans, who fantasy fans, science fiction fans, you know, they're very net savvy. You know, if they want a book, they'll order it from whatever territory it's available in. So it does make it quite difficult, and you do need to try and align publishing dates as much as possible. But it's not really my problem. You know, that's something for the publishing companies to sort out. I would be concerned if, you know, lots of British readers were buying all the American books over, because obviously then the sales over here would tank and my publisher and editor would yell at me repeatedly. But, you know, that's the way it goes.
Did you hear my two-year-old talking to me just now?
I didn't hear a word. I'm too busy listening to the sound of my own voice.
Okay, I still managed to hear most of what you said there. Well, hey, folks, you tell me if you heard my son and let us know in the feedback. He just walked in the door and was all, "Oh, Daddy, Daddy." You can't turn that down, you know.
You can, absolutely.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see, though, because I know I've had this discussion with editors that, you know, you want to respect different regions, but with Amazon, anyone can buy from anywhere if you really want the book, so.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very, very difficult, and that's the way it's going to go. You know, I mean, publishers are going to have to do pretty much global publications. They can't afford to stagger the publications, that, you know, because they're not trusting the way that society is moving. They can't control these things.
Right. I think it would be advantageous for publishers to try to work together in that case, to have books come out simultaneously whenever possible.
Yeah, that would be the day. I don't think they'd trust each other. Yeah, they say, oh, yeah, we'll put it out in November, and then they're quickly making plans to put it out 3 months early, aren't they?
Hey, this is fantasy, right? We can go there.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier you are writing for the screen, and you are a screenwriter for a BBC television drama.
Yes.
So I'm curious, do you prefer writing for screenplays, or do you prefer writing novels?
I like them both equally, to be honest. I mean, they're very different disciplines. You think it's all just words, but I wrote the novels. Well, I was a journalist to start with, then I wrote novels, and then I became a screenwriter. And when I became a screenwriter, I basically had to forget everything I'd learnt writing novels and just start from scratch and relearn a whole new way of putting words and stories together. Now I find it's one influences the other in a way. I mean, they both improve my writing. My writing's much better now than it was before I was a screenwriter. You know, a screenwriter forces you to look at words very carefully, to be tight, not to waste any on-screen time. And that filters through to the novels. But I do enjoy them, and I find it keeps my writing palette clear in a way. You know, you finish a novel, you can do a screenplay after that, a different form of writing. It keeps you fresh. Then you go back to a novel before you get bored with any particular medium.
Do you find that working on screenplays has helped you with pacing as well as with actual dialogue and things like that?
Yeah, totally, because screenwriting is very, very structural. It forces you to be absolutely disciplined about character arcs, about plot, and about, you know, the progression of scenes and sequences of scenes. And you take that discipline with you. In a way, it's easy not to be disciplined or that disciplined when you're working on a novel or a short story or a novella, because you've got so many words to play with, you know. And it makes the stories, I think, better to just slice that flab away and just focus, you know, purely on the story and the characters.
Yeah. I used to live in Southern California, so I had the opportunity while down there to interview several authors who wrote for Hollywood but also had novels published, and they had a pretty common theme they shared, which was the money is great, but it's frustrating to write script after script and treatment after treatment and never see a final result. So they all turned to book writing as a way to fulfill their need to actually have their art be read and be seen by an audience. How does this story compare to your experience writing for BBC?
Well, pretty much everything I've written has actually been produced. So, you know, it's been seen by people. It's a different form of writing because you've got like 20 people who've got an opinion on your story, and they're all sticking bits in here and there and changing words and pulling scenes out, you know, from the producer through the various editors right the way down to the actors before they go on. So it's a collaborative form of storytelling. The novels are just mine. You know, that's my world where I can just do whatever I want and have total control over it. So, you know, both give different things, I think. I've done one or two pilot scripts for the BBC that haven't gone on air, but there's always a chance that they'll come around again, you know. And I think because I've got the novels, I don't care that much if they don't get made. I get the enjoyment out of constructing the story, and in a way, for me, that's more than enough, you know.
Yeah, and at least you do have the novels there that are coming out regularly, so you have that feedback and that interaction from your readers.
Exactly, and I had the novels first, so
yeah.
You know, that's always been the core of what I do and who I am, and the screenwriting was an add-on, really.
Yeah. So do you write for any specific television shows, or are they more like TV movies?
No, I'm a senior writer on a medical drama called Doctors, which is quite a low-key human interest medical drama about the different stories of the people who pass through the medical department every day, and which you've seen all over the world 1,000 times in different forms. But it's great for me because you get to come up with your own story, your own characters, and then you get the serial element, which the BBC gives me, that you sort of weave through your story. But I do actually have some sort of ownership of a story in it, so that's great. Yeah. And I've written for police dramas, other medical dramas, and I've developed a science fiction series, which is still in the process of development hell. It'll get there in the end, I think. It's a near future science fiction series about a group of law enforcement people dealing with the rapidly advancing technology of the world, and this kind of technology that falls into criminal hands. Criminals are always the first to use any new technological advance, and they're normally several paces ahead of the cops. So I think there's plenty of stories there with the way that technology is advancing at the moment.
Oh, that's awesome. So you work on quite a few scripts over the course of a year then?
Yeah. Well, it depends what you mean by quite a few. I will probably do 7 or 8 scripts a year, which is about fine for me. Yeah. That's manageable. It takes about a month to see each script through from idea to final draft. So that's about 8 months, and then 4 months off from screenwriting. But I'll be writing the novels while I'm doing the scripts as well.
Yeah, so that...
I think, you know, it's my journalistic background. I'm not one of these writers that sits around waiting for the muse to come and will knock off 150 words and then go and have a good lie down. You know, I do know lots of writers like that, but I was trained as a journalist. I was trained to hit deadlines, to work hard. You know, you sit there and you make sure that you're creative and find ways to make sure you're creative, and you just be productive and hit those deadlines, you know, and because I'm like that, I found that the more you write, often the better you write and the more you want to write.
Right. No pun intended by me saying right. well, I'm sure that you would love to adapt one of your own works for film. I mean, I'm sure you would. So which one, if you could, pick one of your novels to adapt, say, for a big blockbuster film or something like that, which one would it be?
It would probably be World's End, first Age of Misrule book. There was a lot of personal stuff in there, but I just think it would make a great movie. You know, it's a big screen fantasy. It's got lots of big set pieces, lots of character interplay in there, lots of great themes. You know, I would love to work on that. Need a big budget. You know, you've got dragons blasting cars on the freeway and shape-shifting creatures in the city. So, you know, you need to get a good budget behind it. But, yeah, I would love to do that one.
So maybe Peter Jackson at the helm. Yeah, that sounds like it would be good. Yeah.
Yeah, Peter Jackson, yeah, he'd be pretty good. Or Guillermo del Toro, I think I could see him doing it.
Definitely. Oh, okay. Yeah, definitely. yeah, big things in the freeway. Yeah, it's del Toro.
Yeah, that's definitely up his street.
Other side of the coin here, if you could adapt any other novel not written by you for film, which one would you want to adapt?
I think I would want to adapt The Anubis Gates by Tim Powers.
Oh, I love that book.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites, and I think that would make a fantastic movie. You've got the different time periods, so from my point of view, you've got the history. It just powers, well, again, no pun intended, straight through the story. Good characters, lots of twists and turns. Make a fantastic film, that one.
Yeah, that would. That was a great book. Couldn't put that one down. You know, we've mentioned some of your works here, Mark, and I've noticed you've written several trilogies. There's Age of Misrule and Swords of Albion, which you're working on now. There's Kingdom of the Serpent, The Dark Age. Is that just a natural length for you, or do publishers ask for that?
Publishers in the UK were very keen on they're very keen on trilogies because, you know, from a marketing point of view, it tends to tie readers in for three books. So I think that's why they're interested in it. I originally planned a trilogy of trilogies, of which The Age of Misrule is the first one, The Dark Age is the second one, Kingdom of the Serpent is the third one. They all tie in and make a mosaic story, crossing over and backwards and forwards. So it's a massive endeavor, and I planned that out 10 years ago. I mean, I first wrote The Age of Misrule books, and they were published in the UK 10 years ago. You're just getting them in the States now.
Right.
But it was that was a huge story that I planned out, and I decided to tell it in three book chunks because it was so big, and there's different characters and different focus on each trilogy, but they all feed in together.
So can you read the individual trilogies separately of the other two, or... is it set up that way? Okay, so you don't have to.
Well, that was the original idea. I mean, the final trilogy and The Age of Misrule tie in very closely together. The Dark Age you can sort of pull out and read separately as well. So, you know, I've had people read them totally out of sequence. I mean, I've had there was one reader who read the Age of Misrule trilogy backwards. He got the third book first and read back to the first one, which was to me a slightly bizarre way of doing it. But he said he got a lot out of it. So you know. Whatever works, I think.
Hey, as long as he's reading the books, right?
Absolutely.
So when Age of Misrule got published here a couple years ago when it first started by Pyre, were they still in print and still available in the UK, or had they gone out of print at that point?
No, they've stayed pretty much in print in the UK. The first book was published in May this year by Pyre, World's End. And there was some difficulty, you know, along the lines that we were talking about earlier. Gallant's over here in the UK published an omnibus of The Age of Misrule, and a lot of people in America were ordering from Amazon the omnibus after they got the first book from Pyre, so it makes it very difficult for Lou then to follow through with the others. But the omnibus is now sold out, and it's not being reprinted, so, you know, it's pretty much better for Lou, I think, that way.
Okay, so when did books 2 and 3 come out here then?
Pyre are really good when they do trilogies in that they've been putting them out on consecutive months. So The Age of Misrule came out May, June, July this year. Then The Dark Age is coming out, I think, May, June, July 2010. So people don't have too long to wait in between each installment. Because the way I write often, the books aren't standalone. I'm telling a big story over each trilogy. So it's good. You can pick up the next episode, basically, within a few weeks of finishing the first one.
Oh, you've given me some reading to do, Mark. You know,
that's what I like to hear.
Yeah. Well, Lou has spoken very highly of you, which is why I've been wanting to have you on the show for a while, and I had a hiatus this summer because we moved across the state and yada, yada, yada. So I had sort of forgotten that whole timeline, but now it all rings fresh again. So, Mark, it's been really wonderful having you on the show. Thank you again for making the time. But is there anything else you wanted to talk to us about that I didn't ask you?
I can't think of anything at the moment, Sean. That was a great interview. It's nice to be able to talk about these stories. You know, writers spend their time stuck in a room staring at a computer screen. It's sometimes nice to go out into the world and just, you know, espouse whatever thoughts are passing through your head at the time. So it was great. Thanks for inviting me on. I had a great time.
And folks, please visit markchadbourne.net to learn more about Mark's work. You can find his blog there as well, or you can use the links in the show notes. And we'll be back with more show right after this. Thanks again, Mark.
Bye.
Immortality, longevity, an endless lifespan. What would you do to become immortal?
My name is McAllen Orsel. I'm a genetic scientist in New York. I'm caught in a secret war between two powerful groups of immortals. I've been told that I am a messiah to a group of people I barely know. I'm forced on a quest around the globe to fulfill a destiny I never chose. If only I can stay alive.
From Krzysztof Laputka comes The Leviathan Chronicles, an audio adventure like you've never heard before.
What is Leviathan?
We have been among you for almost a millennia.
What? Immortal?
They can't know about Leviathan.
Blow those charges.
No!
You go!
Why have you brought me here?
You are here because we need your help.
She was never trained for this.
She was bred for it, Anton.
Well, she doesn't know that.
You'll need to find me, McAllen.
To discover the Leviathan Chronicles and get the next dimension in podcasting, go to www.leviathanchronicles.com.
And welcome back to the show. I am joined for this segment by the long-lost Samazon. Hey, Sam.
Hello, my beautiful babies. How are you?
Our beautiful babies are just fine, I'm sure. you know, do you realize that it has been... You haven't been on the show since July?
Yeah, time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, you have been having fun. Actually, before we get to feedback, we have some feedback to do that I've been holding because I prefer to do the feedback when you're here since, you know, half of it's addressed to you specifically. So I don't want to answer it for you. But can you tell us what you've been doing? You've been really busy and all over the place and you're going to make us jealous now, but go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's all that exciting, but I have been doing a lot of traveling, which, you know, besides reading and science fiction and fantasy, probably one of my favorite things to do ever is to travel. So, you know, we had Comic-Con, which is always amazing, and, you know, didn't travel very far for that, just downtown, but had a blast.
And then, here's what people need to understand about your dedication to Comic-Con.
I am dedicated.
Yeah, to a whole new extreme. Folks, even though Sam lives in San Diego, she gets a hotel room and doesn't sleep for 4 days.
Yeah, my husband only has a few weeks off a year, and he takes vacation, you know, his precious vacation. And that is probably our busiest event of the year for the store. And I take vacation during that time. Then we get a hotel room across the street so that we can just walk back and forth so that we'll be that much closer to the action, the sweet, delicious, nerdy action. and or I don't know if it's really sweet and delicious, more like kind of stinky and stale, but that's okay. It's still nerdy and I love it. And we just enjoy it to the full extent. Like, we hardly sleep because we are just having too much fun. You're just meeting all the people you want to meet, seeing all the amazing panels, seeing friends from all over the world who fly in for this weekend that you only see every now and again. You know, they're after parties and all sorts of just great things going on. So Yeah, I love you, Khan.
Now, you always meet someone unexpected, someone famous usually. So who did you meet this year unexpectedly?
Unexpectedly? Lou Anders.
Oh.
Hi, Lou. Lou is having a drink with two other guys I know. And I was walking by and they said, well, you know Lou, don't you? And I went, wait a minute, Lou Anders? And he gave me this look like, yes, should I know you? And then, you know, then it was kismet. It was like, I'm Sam. And he's like, oh, and then we hugged and there was much rejoicing.
And there was much joy. He didn't recognize the sound of your voice.
No, he didn't. Yeah.
Man. Well, you know, you do sound different in person.
I sound silkier and sultrier, don't I?
And,
say yes.
And what did you say earlier? Satin? What was that term? This is before we started recording.
Yeah, now you're embarrassing me. I was complimenting Sean on his silky, sultry, satin of voice.
Triple S, baby. Okay. Now, this is getting rather long. So what else did you do, have you been doing since we last saw you?
Just a bunch of traveling from then on out, visiting friends all over the place. We went to Burning Man. It's indescribable. So all I will say about it is that it is a gigantic music and arts festival in the middle of the desert that is all about radical self-expression and radical self-reliance. And it's an odyssey to get there. So that had been many months in the planning, and we did it, and it was amazing. Visited my dad in Montana. You know, it was just kind of all over the place. But I'm back, and it's weird to return to real life and like, oh, yeah, my job. I have a job and bills and stuff. So I've just been kind of acclimating to that the past week and a half.
Well, it's
and
good.
Here I am.
It's good to have you back. I didn't do a lot of shows while you're gone. I think I only put four up. So as far as number of episodes go, you didn't miss a whole lot. But
oh, that's good.
Yeah, it's good to have you back, though. We missed you.
I'm glad to be back. I mean, that's the bad thing about traveling is that, you know, when I'm off hiking in the mountains of Montana or out in the middle of the desert, I can't really do the podcast. So I do miss it. That's for sure. So all you guys probably thought I was dead, but I'm not dead. Here I am.
Well, last question for you before we jump into this feedback. Did you read any really cool books in the last 2 months?
I did, actually. I've been focusing mostly on young adult this summer, just A, because of my job, and B, it's really good, like, kind of lighter summer reading. I don't need War and Peace, especially when I'm traveling all over the place. I'm picking books up, putting them down. I've been reading, it's all about fantasy for me this summer for some reason, but I think I mentioned this last time I was on the show. Fire by Kristen Cashore was so excellent. She wrote Graceling, which I also highly acclaim, but I think Fire may even be better, and it's about to be released. It's about to be printed, so it's coming out here in a couple of weeks. I read the new Suzanne Collins. That's a big one that just got released, Catching Fire, and it's all about fire for some reason this summer. I'm not sure why, but there's like a gazillion books with fire in the title. It's one of those trends, like the disaster movie trend where like Volcano and Dante's Peak came out at the same year, and I don't know.
Yeah, and you had, what was that, Bruce Willis, Ben Affleck, asteroid movie?
Yes, Deep Impact and Armageddon.
Yeah, in the same summer.
Yeah, and one was good and one made me want to tear my eyes out with tweezers.
And I think we know which was which.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that was a doozy. That was an awesome one. And right now I'm reading a mystery of all things. I know, it's crazy, but it's a really quirky, bizarre little mystery called The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie by Alan Bradley. He's a new author. And it's messed up, man. I'm totally digging it.
No wonder.
The main character is 11. She's English. It's in the 1950s. And she's very much into poison. And that's all I will say about that.
Okay, that sounds a little disturbing.
It's pretty amazing.
I started reading Mistborn by Brandon Sanderson.
Yeah. Do you enjoy?
I am liking it very much. In fact, the reason I've put it off this long, because I have the whole thing, but the reason I put it off is because I have the whole thing, and they're like 500-600 pages each with small, tiny little print. And I'm like, oh man, I don't want to get into that because I know it's good and I don't want to be committed to 600,000 words for one series. Mm-hmm. But I was like, I can't put this off anymore. I have to read it. And first page just grabs you and hooks you. So folks, if you haven't read Mistborn, even though I'm only 50 pages in, I can recommend it already. Check it out. And also, Sam, while you're gone, I think this happened while you're gone. I don't know if you know about this or not. I saw the cover for James Ng's forthcoming novel, and a book review that I wrote has a quote on the back cover. So
you're famous now.
So Lou,
not just infamous, you're famous.
I'm infamous. But I couldn't believe that. But that was pretty awesome. So folks, if you didn't know that, you can actually come to the website, look in the news section, and I put the JPEG up there. It's pretty cool.
It's Sean's little pat on the back to himself.
It's to myself.
You earned it, my friend.
Well, you know, it's credited to the website, as it should be. It's an outlet. And I think it's a credit to all the effort that we've put forth and all the good book reviews that we've put out. It just happened to be chance that the first one that got quoted was one I wrote. But Catherine, she writes at least one review a month, and she does such a phenomenal job. So if you're not reading her book reviews, they're really. I just put one up yesterday that she did. So it's a credit to everyone who's contributed. So thank you all of you who have put content up. We appreciate it. But let's get to this feedback. We've been holding on to this for a couple months. Got a few things to get to. And I want to refresh everyone. Back in July or August when I was talking about Bane's universe closing down, and I made a comment that perhaps the short story market was a little oversaturated. There's so many markets out there, and a lot of them are free. You know, maybe it hurts the numbers a little bit. Not that it's good or bad. It's just a comment I made. And I also made a joke that only men entered the Norse Code contest that I could remember. So that's a little background for the next couple of responses we got.
Right. And the first one is from Dawn. And she actually responded to both of those issues you just mentioned. Dawn says, I'm a woman who listens to your podcast and am in my 40s, just to skew it more. I didn't enter the Norse Code contest because I had already bought and read the book and thought it should go to someone who hadn't. I enjoyed the book and do enjoy your podcast. I also agree about oversaturation. I have multiple tabs saved with stories I want to read but haven't had the time. I hope the real estate exam went well. The California exam is a hard one from what I've heard.
Yeah, it was. Well, I passed it the first time, so that's good.
That's because you're a smarty pants McGee.
That was because I took a weekend course in San Jose the weekend before I took the test. If I hadn't done that 12 or a 16-hour course, I don't think I would have passed the first time. But
oh, really? So it was very helpful then, I assume?
Oh, yeah. It was awesome. And Don, I'm glad you read Norse Code and enjoyed it and pointed out that a woman would have entered it if you hadn't already read it. But I thought it was funny. I got like 13 males. Give me the book.
I don't know. The men like the Vikings, I guess.
I guess so.
Who knew? I did. Anyways. I think that actually happens a lot where people perhaps want to enter some of our contests but have already bought the book or, you know, whatever. There's some other extenuating circumstance.
Well, and I appreciate letting someone who hasn't read it get a copy. So I need to do another one so Don can enter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Adam also weighs in on these subjects. He says, on episode 81, you talked about Bane's universe closing, speculating that it might be, might partly be because we are oversaturated with options. I completely agree with that fact, and I think that it is more a lack of consistency in any magazine that helps speed along their demise. I've held subscriptions for the Big Three and regularly hit upon the major online markets like Bane's, Clark's World, and so forth. My major problem is that 1 month they'll run mind-blowing, world-charting stories one after the other, and then the next month they'll run stories that read more like science philosophy texts or stories that are just so contrived that you'll keep reading just because you can't believe they got published. I have ceased to subscribe to the mags and now just wait for the best of anthologies, which we've talked about, to get my short fiction fix. And even half of these stories are, in my opinion, boring. He goes on to recommend stories by Ted Chiang and wraps up with this. So many short stories nowadays look more like publicity stunts or hacked down versions of novels to me. It's a quickly fading art form. I know this is a very subjective statement, and that a story I think is utterly worthless is, for someone else, a masterpiece. But this is just one fan's opinion, and I beg to be proven wrong because I absolutely love short stories. And that's from Adam.
Oh, thank you, Adam. I think Adam meant world-changing stories, by the way.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know what that... There was a typo there.
Typo strikes again.
I made the best guess that I could.
I know. No, it wasn't your fault. It's totally Adam's fault for not knowing how to spell. Way to go, Adam. I'm just kidding, Adam. Don't hate me.
Sandra, take it away.
Hi, Sean. Hi, Sam. This is Sandra from Vancouver, British Columbia, and I'm finally getting around to sending you guys some feedback to say that I absolutely love your podcast. I found you guys through I Should Be Writing back when you were doing the Keys to Publishing cross promotion, and I listened to 2 episodes and right away knew I needed to hear more. So I went back and I listened to every single episode, and I'm finally caught up and I'm absolutely loving it. Sam, you're awesome. I love you so much. And Sean, as an inspiring writer yourself, you are asking exactly the right questions that I want to hear the answers to from everyone you interview. I think you're probably the best interviewer I've ever heard on a podcast, and I listen to tons. So thank you so much for what you guys are doing, as well as all the information that you're providing. In your first couple of episodes that I heard, you mentioned the World Fantasy Convention in 2008, which I had never heard of, and it just happened to be in Calgary, fairly close to me. So I signed up for that, and they told me about our local convention, the VCon, Vancouver's convention, and so I decided to go to that one first. And the guests of honor at this convention were Kelly Armstrong and Patrick Rothfuss. Now, this is a small convention. It's a very intimate setting, and I got to spend so much time on panels with them and learning from them. It was great. And then I went to the World Fantasy Convention, got super inspired by all the authors there. And because of that experience, as well as listening to your podcast, I managed to start writing seriously again, as well as submitting. And I had my first short story accepted for an anthology called Evolve, which is coming out by Edge Publishing, and they're releasing that at the 2010 World Horror Convention, which is very cool. And I also managed to finish a novel earlier this year, and I'm working on my third draft. So I really have you guys to thank for that, for keeping me motivated and giving me all the information that I need. And I'm so glad that you're back to recording. And my goal now is to be interviewed on this podcast as a published novelist. So I will keep you guys posted on that. And I do have another goal. Sam, I would really like to meet you at Comic-Con. I've never been before, and I'm being talked into it, and also being talked into rocking a few costumes while I'm there. So I think it'd be so great to be able to meet you and take some photos with you, and that would just make my day. So thanks again, both of you, for what you're doing. I completely appreciate it, and you've already influenced me more than I can say. So thank you.
All right. You know, I think everyone should send us feedback like that. Don't you, Sam?
Yeah, singing our praises and saying they want to pose for pictures with us. Heck yes. Sandra, I'm so down like James Brown. I would completely love to do that. I think, though, I don't know, you and I need to brainstorm on what costumes we want to do, because if we're going to pose together, we got to have something coordinated.
Good point.
Yeah. So maybe just something you're reading that you can really imagine, maybe graphic novel sort of thing. I don't know. Sandra, if you're interested, why don't you send some ideas on to the website and we can powwow about it.
There you go. And thank you, Sandra, for sending that. It takes a lot of effort to record feedback like that, because she didn't call the voicemail line. She actually recorded it, encoded the MP3, and then emailed it to us. So that's dedication, and it really means a lot. So thank you very much.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you. And you are far less lazy than I am. Go, Sandra.
And congratulations on your first sale. That's awesome.
James, he had some questions for us. He said, I've just been listening back through the episodes of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing and heard the interview with Scott Sigler in episode 23. That was roughly 2 years ago now, and I was wondering if you have any thoughts about how his attempts to smash the system have turned out. Also, how do you think the recent success of many podcasters in getting their novels published has affected the industry?
All right, well, I'll give a few thoughts on this, Sam, and then, Sam, you let me know if you agree with me or not. But when it comes to Scott Sigler, well, first off, you have to remember that 2 years in publishing doesn't mean much, because that's like 2 months or 2 days in other industries. because publishing moves so slow and changes so slowly. But his second book did really well. I think, I don't know, Sam, if you saw this. If I remember correctly, I think it hit number 43 on the New York Times list. It may have been higher than that, but that's the number that sticks in my brain.
It was somewhere around there.
Okay. And his podcasts certainly seem as strong as ever. Now, Scott recently self-published The Rookie, and he did a really nice, slick hardcover. It's amazing. You know, I haven't gotten a commission check yet, so I haven't been able to order one. But I really want one. I want one so bad, and they're limited in number, so I'm probably not going to get one. But it's a collector's item, and this was Scott's first test to see if his podcast audience and the audience through the books would be enough to self-publish something and to make enough money that he could pay his bills and not only pay for the print run and everything, but actually make a profit on it.
Right.
So it seems to be going well for him, and I should get Scott back on the show and get an update about all this, but I think he's on track. I think he's where he wants to be. Now, how have podcasters impacted publishing? If you combine the sales of Sigler, Hutchins, Harwood, Lafferty, and Selznick and compare them, I'm just guessing here, but if you compare them to just average first-time authors, take five first-time authors who weren't podcasters and compare them to those five, I think the podcasters will stack up really well because a couple of them, you know, they hit the top three of Amazon.com the first day the book was available, and they've just done some pretty impressive numbers. So this is, again, this is probably a question that's better for Lou, but I think they're making noise, and as long as the work remains good and future podcasters come out with good stuff that people enjoy to listen to, I think we're going to see this continue. They'll have a platform to stand on.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you on that. I mean, what's great about becoming a published author after earning some, you know, quote unquote fame as a podcaster is you have a built-in audience. You know, you have people that already like your voice, whether it's actually your voice, your actual voice or your writing voice. They want to hear from you. So I would say, you know, you already have some guaranteed sales right there. And plus it's also a good way to get word of mouth if people who listen to your podcast, you know, free advertising right there in many ways. And back to your comment about publishing, the industry is really peculiar because, you know, your comment about 2 years is kind of like 2 months. That is true and also untrue because books go in and out of print so quickly.
Oh, good point.
That if it didn't catch on kind of right away or do okay right away, in 2 years it's likely to be completely out of print and unavailable. So it's just one of those things. It's got to catch on with somebody at some point in order to continue to be printed and continue to do well. So I'd be really interested to see how Scott's doing and his thoughts on this subject, especially with the whole self-publishing thing. That's a whole another can of worms. Yeah. That people have really strong feelings about. You know, some people think it's totally viable and some people think it's a complete dead end and don't waste your time and money with it. So, so hopefully we can get Scott back on. Sean, get on that.
I need to. and you make a good point. I think that's one of the reasons why all of these podcasters, and it started with Scott, so he gets credit for starting this. They did the Amazon rush where they told everyone, they kept everyone apprised. The books, it was purchased. They let them know what was happening in the publication process. And then they say, okay, it's going to be available on, you know, August 20th. So everyone wait. We're all going to order it on the same day, right? And then you have 5,000 people order the book on the same day. So it creates a big surge. But you know, Sam, that if a first-time novelist sells 5,000 copies total, then it's pretty much a success in science fiction. That's pretty decent. You're going to get another book deal from what I understand anyway. Mm-hmm. So they've... By having those immediate hits, though, like you say, if it's not good, it'll be gone in a couple of months because the turnover is so fast. It gives the books more staying power, I think. This is just me talking off the top of my head.
No, absolutely. I mean, sales give books more staying power. So especially if it starts out with a bang and then goes down to a trickle, that those first few weeks, you know, people are really watching to see where the sales go with it. And so people, meaning, you know, people in the industry, the people who would be perhaps giving you another book deal, right?
Yeah.
And once they have an indication of kind of how your book is doing, you know, that'll make or break another book deal for you. So, or can make or break another book deal for you. So, yeah, absolutely. I think that rush when a book is first released is really important.
And the one last thing I want to add about this, so we don't beat the dead horse too much. You know, we're now seeing publishers releasing podcasts of established authors and making a big deal out of it, as they should. Right now, Orbit is releasing a podcast version of the Ian Banks novel that they're publishing. I've gotten a couple emails from them about it. So they really seem to be pushing, we have a podcast version, we have a podcast version. So that tells me that the podcasters are making an impact.
Absolutely. And like, you know, I touched on earlier, it's a free marketing tool for authors and publishers. So, and, you know, really forward thinking imprints and publishers like Orbit are getting this. It's just like putting up book trailers on, you know, YouTube that look like cinematic movie trailers. Those have been proven to get people to take a look at the books. I mean, everyone's doing it these days. So I think podcasting is very viable when it comes to publishing.
All right, very cool.
Those are my 2 cents, and I'm sticking to them.
And if you add my 2 cents, this show's almost worth a nickel. But that's about what it's worth, too. But that is it for the feedback section. And that's about it for this show. So, Sam, it's good having you back.
It was great to be back. I missed you, silent stalker listeners, lurking in the corners. I missed you. I missed your lurking. And yeah. I missed you, Sean, of course, too.
Yes, I missed having you on. Hopefully in a couple of weeks we can do another one.
Absolutely.
I'm like full-on buried in real estate right now, which is good. So hopefully, though, in every 2 weeks we can put one out for the rest of the year.
Good.
And on that note, we'll see all of you in a few weeks. Thank you very much for listening, as always. And until then,
keep reading.
Thank you for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Please visit our website at adventuresinscifipublishing.com for online interviews, book reviews, news stories, coverage of live events, videos, and much more. You can send us an email at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com and give us a call at 206-350-5029. Music by Cargo Cult from their track Dirt, available at magnatune.com. You've been listening to a Singularity Audio production. To learn more, please visit www.singularityaudio.com.